I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, welcome back to a Wednesday night edition of the Chase Thomas podcast. I am joined by someone I have not talked hoops with this season, and that needed to change. Sean Hyken. Sean, good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Good to be with you.
What are you watching right now, Sean? What have you found yourself watching a lot of? Who have you watched in the last week? Who in your league pass rankings? Like, how would you do it right now?
This is kind of an interesting year for that, because I've kind of found myself doing a lot less of like, oh, I'm going to watch this team right now, or I'm going to watch this game, like, because there's so many blowouts this year. Everything is just so chaotic right now that I'll find myself saying, okay, this game looks like it's going to be good, but then, oh, now that game is a 20-point blowout. I'm going to just flip on and watch something else. I kind of find myself bouncing around a lot between a lot of different games as opposed to just kind of focusing on a few teams that I like. I like the Cavs a lot. I think they're interesting. I've liked the Rockets since the Harden trade and since they got Wall back. I think they're fun. I've seen, you know, how good John Wall has looked after the torn Achilles, I think is pretty awesome. I like, who else? LaMelo's fun.
The Hornets are just fun in general.
Yeah, they're not very good, but they're fun. Miles Bridges is awesome.
Do you think he gets traded?
Why would he?
Well, I mean, he doesn't really, like, he's not going to be one of their closing five, right? They still start PJ Washington, unless I'm mistaken. Cody Zeller's back. I don't know what their closing group would make sense with Hayward and LaMelo and Terry Rozier, and you still have the Devontae Graham question. But, I mean, I don't think he's a core piece. I would not say that Miles Bridges in their core plans would be my guess.
I think that's interesting. I have not heard them about them shopping him, or it might be.
And
like
I'm not suggesting they are. I'm just saying that's something when I think about, like, we forget that these young teams, and this is something that the Grizzlies are going to have to think about.
Right.
Guess what? Bane and this group and Tillman, they're all fun. Guess what? You can't play them on. Most of them are going to be gone. And they get pricey. Young guys get expensive. And guess what? You're not going to have five studs, like, on your starting roster. It's not how development works. It's not how the NBA works. It's just not that clean. It never works like that. You eventually have to make moves, and you have to move guys, and it's just not how it works. So some of these guys are going to work out. Some are going to have to get moved. Some are just going to just go the opposite way. Progress is not linear, and sports fans tend to forget that, it seems like. But no, I don't know. I just don't think Miles Bridges is going to be in their closing five, or they want him in their closing five. So at that point, you're like, what is he around for the long term? And my guess would be no.
Well, it's going to depend on how much money he's either going to want or that other teams. It might be kind of a John Collins situation in Atlanta, yeah, where he wants a lot of money. He wants maybe more money than they're willing to pay him if they don't see him as one of the core guys. And then they either have to trade him or some team gives him this huge offer sheet when he's a free agent. And then they have to decide whether they want to match it or not. And he's what? He's only in year three, right?
Yeah, he's 22. But
yeah, so they've got a little time to figure that out.
They do. I just, when I forecast that team, I don't know. I don't think he's probably in there. He's going to be in that group. The Julius Randle situation.
When you're the Hornets, though, like, they've got, like, LaMelo's their guy now, but, like, and they just paid Hayward a lot of money. But, like, they're not the kind of team where I feel like they can afford to just, like, cut bait on somebody who's as talented as him just because it's not a perfect fit. They're not a team where I look at them and say, oh, they have so much talent, they have so many more good pieces that, you know, they can just go ahead and, you know, I don't think Miles Bridges is a luxury for them. Even if he's not in their closing five, he does play a role on that team
for sure. But eventually he's going to want to expand his role. He's eventually going to want to do what Julius Randle is doing in New York. Like, if that's eventually going to be his what he wants.
Maybe. I don't know him at all. I don't really know.
Well, it just seems like those are those kind of players. Like, John Collins thinks that he can dribble and lead the offense and get more possessions.
Jeremy Grant too. That's why he went to Freud, and he's playing a lot more minutes and scoring a lot more points, and they're one of the worst teams in the league. So.
Exactly. That's where Bridges will go. Like, if he wants to continue flourishing in his role as a sixth, seventh guy, energy guy, then yeah, it'll be great for him to stay in Charlotte. But does he eventually want to move on? Because guess what? He was a number 12 overall pick. Like, he was still a lottery pick. He still sees that as, like, I'm a lottery guy. I don't know. Like, the Malik Monk.
I don't know what
world.
His mindset is. I haven't talked to him at all.
Yeah. I'm just extrapolating here, I guess. But that would be my guess with how basketball seems to work on this front. How many minutes would you guess Miles Bridges plays every night?
22.
Ooh, very close. 24.
Okay.
He's playing half the game. Like, he's just not a core piece. He's not someone who's not getting 36 minutes. He's not I don't know. He's kind of an odd player to build around anyway. Like, I don't know. What do you think he does best? What do you think is the best thing about Miles Bridges?
Dunks.
Yeah, you don't build. That's not a core piece. You don't build around dunkers. You don't build with dunkers, I should say. In today's NBA. That seems like a bad idea. I'm not going for Derrick Jones.
We'll see how. I mean, Derrick Jones has been pretty good for.
He's fine, but he bounced around the league. Like, that's, you're like, yeah, you're not in our core. You go be good for somebody else. Go be the good eighth or ninth guy for somebody else.
But you need those guys though.
For sure. But I'm saying teams who are bad, who are developing, they don't keep all of them. Like, you keep some and you don't keep others, and you sign veterans to assist the young guys. It's the Hawks thing where it's like, well, yeah, we have our young guys, but we still need some veterans so the young guys can do more, and we just pick our young guys and we'll have to pick some and not others. They'll pick Capella as the vet and they'll move on from Collins. Like, you can't keep them both long term. Like, you can't just have seven youthful guys like the Grizzlies have right now and then just be like, yep, he's going to be our seven for the next 10 years. We have our guy who loves his role. Like, Bane's going to always do this, and Tillman's always going to do that, and Dylan Brooks is always going to be this, and John Morant's always going to be that, and Jaren Jackson's going to be this. It's just not how it works, man. Like, it's not going to be this clean. Like, some of them are going to be gone. Some of them are not. You're not going to pay them all. You're going to have to make tough choices. You're going to swap some of them out for veterans because you're going to get ahead of schedule. Or you go the opposite way and you actually don't develop the right way, and then you're just flooded in basketball purgatory. That's how I look at it. It's very difficult, and I always get very nervous when it comes to teams like that. Am I overselling my concern with the Grizzlies? Because I go back and forth on this a lot. I think maybe it stems from, I think, Kevin O'Connor's YouTube show on The Ringers. Is it called The Void, I want to say?
I think so.
Okay. Well, he had that whole thing about...
I haven't watched much of it.
Well, it says, like, he had this whole video, which is pretty solid, about, like, them building their next contender around Ja and why it makes sense. And I'm like, well, they're probably not, like, building a contender. I think they're building a really good team. But eventually they're going to have to pick some. Like, they're going to have to do what the Nuggets did. The Nuggets are not, like, Gary Harris, we thought, there was an article by a friend of the pod, Chris Herring, about, like, could he be the next Kawhi Leonard? And he didn't. Now he can't shoot. Now he's just a wing. Just a forgotten wing that is not a part of their long-term plans. It doesn't matter anymore. So you look at that, and you look at Torrey Craig, great role player for them last year. Couldn't keep him. Moved on. Jeremy Grant, great role player for them last year. Couldn't keep him. But they have their guys they do keep. Jokic, Murray, Michael Porter. You have your couple that you do pinpoint, but you don't keep them all. And the role players are usually the ones who get moved. And Bane will not be a Grizzly 5 years from now. Tillman won't be a Grizzly 7 years from now. It's not how I don't think that's how you look at it. And then Dylan Brooks for sure won't be 7 years from now. But I'm not as high on their potential ceiling as like a contender. Like, I think Ja could be like a top 10 player. Do I think he could be a top 5? No. Do I think Jaren Jackson could be a top 5? No. So you're not a contender. Contenders
are very
small.
So they might as well just blow it up.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Not what I'm saying. We just don't have to get ridiculous and throw out contender. It's like, you're not building a contender. You're building a really good team and a good foundation that can be good in the NBA for 10 years. Those are two different conversations.
I definitely agree that people maybe get a little bit ahead of themselves with a lot of, because I think the thing that happened 10 years ago or whatever with Oklahoma City when they had Durant, Westbrook, and Harden, where they, you know, they had that steady climb of,
yes,
1 year they're terrible, the next year they make the playoffs and are competitive with the Lakers in the first round, the next year they lose in the conference finals, then the next year they get to the finals against Miami. I think that it's very easy then to extrapolate that to just every,
yes,
time there's a team that has a few exciting young guys. Like, you know, we did this like however many years ago that, you know, that Minnesota, when after Kat's rookie year, it was like, oh, they have talent.
Exactly.
Be there. They're going to be the next rising. I feel like we kind of did that to a degree with New Orleans too, and when they got Zion, and then they got all the guys that they got in the Anthony Davis trade, it's like, oh, whenever there's a team with a lot of young guys that are really good or that look like they could be really good, we just kind of assume that, oh, we're, you know, I mean, the thing that you just said about development not being linear, I think, is a good point. And I was kind of low on Memphis going into this season because I just kind of felt like maybe they overachieved a little bit and played over their head last year, just because I don't think anybody was really expecting Ja to be as good right away as he ended up being. But I mean, the thing is though, like, once you have one guy who's like that dude, and Ja Morant, I think we can pretty clearly say is that guy. He's like, he's that good. Like, I think, like, he's, you know, a perennial all-star, like all
NBA
level.
I mean, do you think he's ever going to reach first team all NBA status?
I don't know. Maybe he could.
Hmm. I mean, that's where he has to get if you're going to jump into contender status. It's like, he has to get in that conversation. And
I could see him getting into that conversation. I think he's good enough to be, you know, in that group. Maybe not right now, but like 2 or 3 years from now,
yeah,
I could see him that good. But when you have that guy who's like, you have one guy who's like that dude, it's a lot easier to kind of figure out the rest later if you build your team smartly. And that's, you know, it's kind of the difference between, you know, how New Orleans went about building around Anthony Davis, and they, you know, you can kind of see the logic of some of the moves that they were trying to make, but a lot of them didn't pan out, and then that ended up going the way that it went, versus, I guess, how, you know, what, you know, going up, you know, into like when Giannis like started winning MVPs, you know, some of the teams that they put around him, I feel like we're a little bit smarter than maybe, you know, what New Orleans did with Anthony Davis. So it's just going to be interesting to see what happens, and, you know, going forward with Memphis and what they decide to put around Ja. The other thing is, can Jaren Jackson ever get healthy? That's kind of the elephant in the room here, because this is going to be the offseason when they have to decide what about his rookie extension. And I do think that they're going to end up giving him one.
I was gonna say, you're Memphis, you do it.
Oh, yeah. No, I think they're going to, and I think it's the right gamble to make. I think he's good enough that if he can stay healthy, that, you know, he is a core piece, and he's, you know, he's a great number two guy on a team that could be pretty good. But it's just, you know, is he ever going to be able to stay healthy? He's had injuries, you know, his entire, all 3 years now, you know, he's dealt with stuff. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of unfolds.
Yeah. Did you read the ESPN piece from a couple days back on the NBA G League Ignite plan?
Yeah, it seems interesting. I like that they're doing that.
I'm fascinated by it. I don't know if it's getting talked about enough, but like the ins and outs and like them putting them in this bubble and making the vets work with the youth, and like, this was the biggest thing about, like, I was so curious, is that with all the, there's a lot of NBA Twitter that really dismisses the college game and hates it and blah, blah, blah. And I enjoy both. I watch both, but it's just different. And there is something about dominating in college, and there's something about dominating in high school, and there's something about learning how to just be an man among boys with a lot of guys over the course of a season. Like Kevin Durant benefited from being at Texas and just being a superstar. Carmelo benefited from being the guy on a championship team. Syracuse, it's not for everybody. It doesn't mean it's not a precursor to success, obviously, but I do wonder about guys like Jalen Green, who seems to be a potential top three pick in the draft this year, how it works when you're just playing with a bunch of 30 plus guys. And like Luka was doing that in EuroLeague and made him better, and he survived. But you never have any idea which way this is going to go, and you could lose all your confidence. You could just get demoralized, and the NBA G League team, like this Ignite team, could really struggle, and Green could struggle, and Isaiah Todd could struggle, and Deshaun Nix can struggle, and Jonathan Kuminga can struggle. And then, you know, and then you're like, oh, wow, I'm no longer the big man on campus. And I think that is something that I'm so fascinated by seeing, is just what they do when they're matched up with grown men who are fighting for their jobs and fighting for future jobs. And I like the Rayshon Tates of the world. And I'm just very curious to see how it unfolds. It does seem like they're really, really doing everything they can. And I like that they're also doing like online school through Arizona State, which is cool while they're doing this. But it's a tough life. They're like quarantining. They're all in like one apartment complex type deal where the vets and the rookies are all together, and they separate them. They come in together. They have their days completely laid out. The vets go and work out at one point, and then the kids come in and work out. It's a very fascinating development. It's just like the IMG Academy in Florida for high school for pros.
Yeah, well, I think that the thing, I mean, I certainly understand what you're saying about like the competition level, and maybe, you know, playing against better players or sooner might destroy their confidence. But I think the other thing you have to keep in mind, though, is when you're, you know, on one of these G League teams, your entire job is to play basketball. Whereas, you know, when you're in college, you know, you have to, I mean, I know a lot of these guys kind of get, you know, their hands held through these kind of joke classes, but you still have to go through the charade of pretending to be a college student and keep your grades up. And it's, you know, you have other obligations, you have all this stuff. When basketball is your only job, A, you're getting paid for it, which, you know, that's a whole other discussion about the college game that, you know, that's another thing. I can understand why some guys would choose this G League thing. But also, you're going to have access. If you're in the G League and you're on like the NBA, you know, in the NBA infrastructure already, you're going to have access to way better, you know, nutritionists. You're going to have access to better trainers. You're going to have access to kind of all of this medical stuff and just kind of the conditioning stuff. And you're going to have coaches that are, you know, they're have NBA experience. You're playing against guys that have NBA experience. And I mean, it's just going to depend on how each individual guy goes into it, whether it's, you know, somebody's like, I don't think you go to this G League, the G League Ignite team, and say, oh, well, I'm going to this team because I want to dominate and I want to, you know, win. You go to this because you're saying, you know, this is a long term investment in me getting better, and maybe my numbers aren't going to look as impressive playing against professionals as they would look in college. But I think at this point, scouts are smart enough that they can look at players and, you know, watch actually, you know, how they play, and not so much focus on, oh, well, did this team win, you know, in the NCAA tournament? And like, something a scout actually told me not too long ago is when you're scouting a player, you have to look at, you know, what can this guy bring when everybody on his team or everybody in the game is better than him? Because most of these guys, you know, these big like high school, college guys who are like high recruits or guys who are going to be high draft picks, those guys have mostly been the best player on every team they've ever been on. And once you get to the NBA, unless you're like Luka or Ja or, you know, one of the like two rookies a year that is actually good right away, that's not going to be the case for you. And so you have to, you know, I almost feel like it's better for these guys to go to these G League situations where they're playing against NBA players, and they kind of have to learn, even if it's somebody who's going to be a star eventually, learn how to be a role player and learn how to, you know, learn how
but
to
isn't
function
that a problem when, potentially, if you learn how to be a role player at 18 rather than get a high usage and fail like Steph Curry turning the ball over 10 times a game and learning how to just be bad and just working through it in an NBA level versus the G League and just carving out a niche as like a corner three guy?
But then, but if you have the talent, you're going to be able to adapt to it.
Maybe,
no matter what.
But you're young, man. 18 in the formative years, the 18 to 23. It's like that's we know who you are by 23 to 24 in the NBA. Like we have an idea once you get that 5-6 year track record. Like this is who this person is. Like those years early on matter. And if you learn to play a certain way, and they are Brian Shaw, the coach of the Ignite, he just sees them differently than how a college coach or just an NBA coach would see them and just throw them to the wolves. I don't know. This is just complicated. I don't think there's a right answer here, Sean. And I think it affects everybody differently.
That's what I'm saying. This thing kind of, you know, this program, I think kind of self-selects for people who aren't going into it looking to be like, I think the guys that get developed in this program might end up becoming high level role players, but you know what? Most guys that you draft, you'd be happy if they end up being high level role players. Like there's only maybe two or three guys a year who are stars. And, you know, if you're one of these good teams, if you're a team like, you know, the I don't know, who's a team that like if you're like, you know, Dallas, and you already have Luka, you don't need another guy to be like the first option. You know, you maybe are happier drafting a guy who has had this kind of NBA adjacent development system for, you know, already for a whole season and is going to be able to slide in and know his role. Like I think this might be more useful to good teams than to teams that are just taking swings on talent. I think that those teams might end up still kind of drafting more of the one and done college guys, but I definitely think it's good that these guys have these options.
It's good. I'm all about more options and I 100% agree there. I'm curious to see how they are developed. I'm curious to see how they're taught. I'm curious to see if Shaw's like, hey, Green is going to be a lottery guy, so I have to let him go out and fail against these G League guys, and he treats certain guys differently. Does Kuminga get treated differently than Green? Does Green get special treatment? Like, I don't know. Like, if you go to a college campus, you get special treatment. If you are in the G League with a bunch of grown men, you're not. And some guys will benefit from that. Others will not. I don't know. I think it's very fascinating, and I'm curious to see how this all looks. Speaking of fascinating things, have you seen how often Doug McDermott is cutting to the basket now? Is this a new development this year? Did I completely space on Doug McDermott just being an elite crasher? Because he had 22 points in the paint on the 28th. So this was like last week. But like just seeing that and seeing his stat line, and then I just had to go watch how he played. And then tonight against the Bucks, I'm like, Doug McDermott is interesting. And the McDermott-Sabonis connection is just incredible. And he found McDermott a bunch in that game that I'm referring to. But Sabonis is just doing everything, offensive, defensive, rebounding, an elite passer. He's had some zips that are just bonkers. What do you make of the Pacers, and what do you make of McDermott and Sabonis specifically?
Well, Doug is in the category of, you know, if you will, sneaky athletic.
Oh.
If you will. Mm-hmm, I covered him... I covered him with the Bulls his first 3 years in the league. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was drafted in 14. He was traded. So he had some dunks in some of those early games where, you know, and he and I would always joke about like him entering the dunk contest. Obviously, you know, he comes out of Creighton, and he's kind of pigeonholed as a shooter just because, you know, white guy went to the same school as Kyle Korver, and so that's kind of thought of as his skill set. But he's definitely like he can get up, and you know, so him cutting to the basket, I don't have the usage stats in front of me about how much he's, you know, doing that now versus
it's high
before,
I'm gonna go ahead and tell you it's definitely high.
Okay, well, good for him. I mean, I think he's generally been pretty good since he signed in Indy.
He has to do a lot more now.
Well, right, but like I think he was also just like he was always like he was in this weird like the Bulls never used him well, and then he was in Oklahoma City for like half a season, and then he signed with the Knicks, or he was traded to the Knicks.
Yeah,
and then the Knicks are always terrible, and then he gets traded to Dallas, and then he signs it. So he kind of
was
bounced
he really
around
on Dallas. I don't even remember that.
Yeah, he was in the Porzingis trade.
Oh my!
Or no, no. He wasn't in the Porzingis. Was he in the Porzingis trade? He might have been in the Porzingis trade. I know he got traded from New York to Dallas at
remember.
One point.
Yeah,
but you know the point is he kind of bounced around.
He was in the Dennis Smith trade, or is that Porzingis? Are they all together?
Were those separate trades?
I don't know.
No, I think that was
this
the
was
same
2 years
trade.
Ago. Now,
no, those were the same trade.
It was the same trade. So yeah, they were all in it together then.
Wait, no. He was trade. I don't. That, this isn't. That's not. That's not a point. Is he was. I just remember he was
Doug
traded
McDermott
from New
super
York.
Fans are getting so upset. Like
I like Doug a lot. Actually, he was one of my favorite guys that I covered because he just like. He was fun to talk to because he never knew what he was or wasn't supposed to say. Like he would always
really?
Just kind of, yeah, he was like one time his second Hoiberg year.
Okay.
He was going to start a game
mm-hmm.
and Fred said at shoot around that he hadn't decided who he was going to start. And then he said pregame that he had just told Doug like 5 minutes beforehand that he was going to start. Mm. And then Doug in the locker room, Doug was like, yeah, Fred told me at shoot around. So just little stuff like that. But then also like, you know, he's a guy I would talk to about like just different stuff going on in the locker room. And it was, you know, not like on the record, but he was great. Cause I think he just didn't know what he was or wasn't supposed to say, but no, I actually like Doug a lot. He's a good dude.
How was LaVine?
I didn't really overlap with Zach that much. Okay. Because the year he got there was the year that I left.
Okay.
And he wasn't really around much. Because
so who were your final guys? Who were the final ones that you were talking to a lot in Chicago?
My last full year was the three alphas year, the Rondo Wade Butler year.
Interesting.
Which was fun.
God, what a time.
That was fun. That was an experience. I liked Taj, I think, is one of my favorite guys I've ever covered. He's just
interesting. Why?
Because he's just a really good dude. He's just always positive. He's always willing to talk. He's just a good, like, some guys are just like some of those role players. Like Ed Davis is like this too, who I had in Portland for a couple of years. Just mm-hmm. just good, solid dudes. Like I like him. Robin Lopez, I like a lot. I like Bobby Portis. Bobby's a funny kid. I shouldn't say kid. He was a kid at the time. He's not a kid now, but. Bobby, I was cool with. I actually am still kind of cool with Bobby.
Interesting.
So for Chicago, I think those were kind of, yeah, but Doug and I always got along pretty well, too.
Hmm. What about Hoiberg? Do you miss talking to Hoiberg?
Fred's
a nice
guy.
He feels like a tough interview.
Well, it depends on what you want. If he is the most, like, he is extremely, yes, like, Vinny Goodwill, who covers the NBA for Yahoo now and was on the Bulls beat at the time, he used to say that calling Fred vanilla is an insult to vanilla extract. Because, Fred's like the nicest dude that you'll ever come across. But he is like, and I don't think he's like trying to be difficult. I think he's like the opposite of Doug in terms of like knowing what you can and can't say. Fred is so cautious about like not offending anybody that he just will not. Say anything even mildly controversial. And so when you're a beat writer, you're not really, but then, you know, there are times I think later on, you know, he got better, I think, about sticking up for himself a little bit when some of the public, you know, consensus got to be against him. One time he didn't like something I wrote and he, you know, called me and was like upset about it. And we talked about it for,
really?
Yeah. That's what happens when you're on the beat though. Like that's just, you know, you'll get those calls. You'll get those texts from, you know, the coaches and the GMs, and it's just kind of, you know, it's something you got to deal with. That's why I just like, I'm never gonna like, you know, when I'm writing stuff, or I'm saying stuff on a podcast, I'm never gonna publicly call for a coach or a GM to get fired, because I feel like if you're gonna write or say that kind of stuff. You don't. I feel like you shouldn't, you know, write or say anything like that that you wouldn't say to their face.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's. I mean, I don't know. Fred's a good guy. I actually just texted with Fred like a week ago when he announced.
Okay.
How
many coaches are you texting with right now, Sean Hyken?
No comment. But no, I'm saying like because he announced that he got. He tested positive for COVID, and so I just sent him a quick text like, hey man, sorry to hear that, get well soon. And he sent me a text back saying thanks. That was the extent of it, but that was just like a week ago.
Interesting. We've touched on the Blazers a little bit, the team that you grew up covering and loving, the biggest Blazers fan I know, Sean Hyken.
I was when I was a fan of a team. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you not? So do you feel nothing when you watch the Blazers? You really don't feel anything?
I mean, I like it when they do well because that's good for me professionally, but like,
is it?
It is. Why would it not be?
I don't know. I feel like covering a bad team is more interesting than covering a really good team.
Depends. Again, it depends on the personalities. It depends on all that. I mean, I think the thing that I have a little bit of freedom for is like I don't really cover the Blazers on a day-to-day basis. I just happen to be based here.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't really write about the Blazers that much because there's not a lot of national, you know, when you're writing for BR, it's a national outlet. There's just not a lot of national interest in the Blazers unless it's like either Dame is, you know, doing something like if he had that week where he like last season where he scored 50 points like three games in a row or whatever, or when they signed Carmelo Anthony after being on the scrap heap for a year, that's like the biggest story in the league for a week. That's when there's national interest in the Blazers. Generally speaking, I don't really write about them very much.
Yeah, that's fair. How are they surviving without Collins, without McCollum, without Nurkic? What, when you're watching the Blazers, how are they doing this?
Dame?
Is it really just Dame? Is that it? Gary Trent's playing like 40 minutes a night right now,
Gary Trent's been pretty good, actually. But
he's been okay.
Like, it's been a lot. You want to talk about guys who are going to get paid this summer? He's going to get paid. It really is just how good Dame is. Like when you look at, especially, you know, Robert Covington has, you know, he's been pretty good defensively, but he has not shot well, or certainly as well as he shot last year in Houston. Derek Jones has been, we talked about a little bit before, he was good defense. He's been good defensively, but now he's injured. Ennis Kanter, who's, you know, it's easy for him to become a punchline. He's fine. He does what he's supposed to do. He's a terrible defender, but he gets rebounds. He can score around the basket. He's fine. He does his job. But when you're asking him to play a lot of minutes, it's not good. It really is just Dame.
Interesting. So what is Dame doing? Is there anything about Dame's game that's adjusted without those three? Because, I mean, we know about the Nurkic and him assisting each other from a year ago, and we know how McCollum was playing to start this year and how they were playing in the bubble and stuff, and Zach Collins just unfortunately cannot stay healthy. Is there anything different about Dame this year that you've noticed?
No, he's just having another Dame year. It's all just kind of, he had this a little bit last year before the, or not last year, 2 years ago, the year that they went to the conference finals late in that regular season. CJ missed a few weeks with a knee injury, and Dame was basically doing the same thing and kept them in contention and kept them in the, I think they were the three seed that year. He's just having another Dame year. He's one of those guys, I think he's a floor raiser. He's one of those guys where, you know, as long as you have him and he's healthy, there's only so bad that you can be.
Interesting.
No matter who you've got around him.
And watching Rodney Hood this year, too, he's good. And he tore his Achilles.
He's working his way back. He's had some really good games. He has had some games where it seems like he's kind of still feeling his way back. But that's a pretty big injury to come back from. So.
But that's what I was thinking. Like, we mentioned Wall at the top of this show, and we have Durant, we have Wall, we have Rodney Hood.
I mean, Durant's been incredible. Durant literally just looks exactly like old Kevin Durant.
Right. And it's when do you think we're going to get to the point where it's like we're going to have to start reassessing how we look at Achilles injuries?
Well, if you want to expand this to the WNBA, look at Breanna Stewart, missed a whole season with a torn Achilles and then won finals MVP in the bubble over the summer. I don't want to give too much away, but I may or may not be working on something about this right now. I'm still kind of digging into all that stuff. Maybe we'll talk again whenever that happens.
I stumbled into great minds, Sean Hyken.
But that's something that I've been thinking. I think obviously the hook there is that Durant looks like Kevin Durant again, and he just looks incredible. But, you know, you're starting to see more and more guys that, I mean, even just as recently as like 4 or 5 years ago, Wesley Matthews tears his Achilles, was never the same guy after that.
Yep.
This year, Dwight Powell's a guy who just looks totally done now after the torn Achilles. Brandon Jennings was never the same after a torn Achilles. I think the only guy I can think of before, you know, in the current NBA, like obviously back in the day, like Dominique had his, and then he was pretty good for a year after that. But, Rudy Gay, I think, is the one guy that, like, he tore his in Sacramento. He signed with the Spurs, and he was fine. And he's basically been the same player since then. And he's, you know, continued to be a useful rotation player, and he basically hasn't changed his game at all. But it is getting to a point, I think, where, and I think it's just like with anything, like a torn ACL. Like, remember back in the 80s, Bernard King tore his ACL and it basically almost ended his career. Now it's like a torn ACL is like, you know, like Zach LaVine had a torn ACL and he was fine. Like, so many more guys like tear their ACLs and then they're okay.
Yeah. What happened to Davis Bertans? He was like 2 for 10 the other night. What is going on with Bertans? Why does he suck?
I don't know. That's a good question. It could be, you know, it could be like a Nick Batum thing with him where he gets traded from a good team to a bad team. And then he has one really good year, gets a big contract, and then he's just like terrible. And that, are we maybe talking about in 2 years or 3 years or whenever his contract is like about to be up, he gets bought out by the Wizards, and then he goes to like Golden State and is shooting 45% from three again, like what Batum is doing with the Clippers.
I wouldn't rule it out. Just rough.
The Wizards are a pretty rough watch right now, except for Beal.
They are a rough watch. I also think it's interesting, like the Beal stuff. Did you see someone, who was it who tweeted about, like, it's so hard to keep up with everything, but like Beal being, this is like the happiest he's ever been this season. And
oh, I saw the tweet that was like, sources say
yes,
Bradley Beal is even happier this season.
Yes, that's
than
what
he
I'm referring
last
to.
Season.
Now, people scoffed at that, like it's horrible, and we see the memes of him like really sad on the sideline and like just losing his mind.
Which, by the way, he knows that that's going to be a thing.
100%.
Whenever he's like sitting on the bench,
yes,
he knows that he's
performative.
The camera's going to be on him. It's 100% a put on. Like he's kind of like, he's not doing the, you know, the James Harden or Anthony Davis of like outright like saying, oh, get me out of here. But
like on the court,
he knows
yeah,
that he's going to get made into a meme. So he's kind of just, you know, he's not preventing that from happening.
Yes. I will also say, when people scoff at that, like, this is why you have to look at athletes individually. And there is, I guarantee you, some athletes who look at the situation that Beal's in, the way they think is like, hey, this is awesome. This is like the best situation possible, because guess what? Everybody feels sorry for him. Everybody's like, we got to save Bradley Beal. Look at how awesome Bradley Beal is. This helps Bradley Beal. He leads the NBA in points per game still, right? Like, this
I
is,
I think so.
This helps him. Him being on a bad team this year helps the legacy of Bradley Beal. It helps his image. Everything about Bradley.
Assuming that he ends up on a good team eventually.
Right. But, like, he doesn't have to rush it. So, like, them saying, like, when people were dunking on that, I was like, honestly, my first thought was like, that wouldn't surprise me. That would not be a crazy thing for me to think that he's enjoying just being the guy that everybody feels sorry for, and that he gets to go off and play. Put up insane numbers on a bad team. And
well, the thing you also have to keep in mind is I don't think he wants to get traded right now because the logistics of getting traded during a pandemic and having to change teams mid-season just seems like, I know obviously Harden did it and like that trade happened, but that just seems like it's a nightmare, even more so than having to move during a season normally is. That's why I think a lot of these teams where you would think that they would have, like, you would think that the Wizards would have fired Scott Brooks by now. You would think that the Timberwolves would have fired Ryan Saunders right by now. Like, I don't think we're going to see a lot of in-season trades, and I don't think we're going to see a lot of in-season coach firings just because the pandemic is just making all that stuff harder from a logistical standpoint.
The Saunders stuff is atrocious. I watched the Wolves-Hawks game from like a week and a half ago. That's the worst coach team in the basketball. Like, you make all the jokes you want about Scottie Brooks, but like, good
Scott
God.
Brooks is fine. He's fine. He's a
Ryan Saunders is a bad NBA coach. Like, he's just a bad NBA coach. They are discombobulated. They're a mess. Like, that is a mess. That it's just, I don't even know how you get out of it in Minnesota. There was something else I was going to mention about Washington, and I completely forgot about what it was going to be now. Kelly Oubre.
Crumbling under the pressure of Joe Lacob's luxury tax. Or whatever it was that he was asked about.
Oh, my God. Important questions, Sean Heitken. Minus 25 last night. There's something to, like, him being the one guy, and now that Kevon Looney's missing time, which is not good for the Warriors. But, like, what do you make of Kelly Oubre this season? Because it seems like they're on national television every night for some reason. But
well, what do you mean for some reason? They still have Steph Curry. Like,
they do have Steph Curry, but it's just too much. They're not a good watch. The Warriors, outside of Steph, and I love Steph, but... They're a tough watch.
they are a tough watch, but, you know, the NBA wants to promote, you know, when people see Steph Curry's going to be on TV, I don't think most people who are deciding whether they want to watch a game or not are like looking at Kelly Oubre's plus minus. They see Steph Curry's name in the ad and are like, okay, I'm going to tune in for that.
That's true. What do you make of his game this year? Is there any chance of improving? Would you look to be moving Kelly Oubre for a different fit? Like, why do you think it's not working for him in Golden State?
If you can get something for him, I just don't know what you're going to... I think you do try to move him just because that's the only way that I think they're going to be able to upgrade at all in the next couple of years, just because everybody... Like, if he's making, like, what, 15 this year?
Yeah.
He's going to be a free agent. So if he walks, they have no way of replacing that cap, you know, figure.
Can I tell you what you do?
What?
You call New Orleans. Like, you see what it takes for J.J. or Lonzo. Like, that's what you do.
Haven't they already talked about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes the most sense. Like, that is what you do. It's one of those two. Whoever you can get
of
the two.
I think they have had those conversations, and actually the way that I heard it talked about was that New Orleans was actually the one that called them about it, and the Warriors weren't interested. I don't know how long ago that was or what, but...
Yeah, how much? He's making 14.
That's the way I understand that it happened.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's dumb. Golden State, Bob Myers, big fan of the Chase Downs podcast. Pick up the phone and talk, because guess what? JJ making 13 on last year's deal. Lonzo making 11. Kelly Oubre making 14 last year. Like, just don't make it complicated. Just do a normal NBA trade for once. Just do a swap.
I mean, we'll see. I mean, I would guess that they do something, but I also just feel like I think this year their team just kind of is what it is, and I mean, this is like the best case scenario of what they've gotten out of Andrew Wiggins. Like, I was totally done with him, and he's actually been pretty good for stretches this year in Golden State. Like the Wiseman thing, like, he's, you know, he's injured, he's going to be out for a little bit, but, you know, and he's kind of was up and down before, so. It's all just kind of like this is just a year where, like, you know, you're happy if you make the playoffs. You have that Minnesota pick, like, you're going to have a high pick either way. Like, you do. I think you do try to do something with Oubre just because you're going to lose him for nothing. If you're going to lose that much, you're not going to be able to replace that cap number or like that cap figure if you don't trade him and maybe get somebody who's already under contract. But yeah, he has not been good. I thought that would be a better fit. But I also, in retrospect, I'm wondering if maybe we should have, you know, cooled it off a little bit on talking about what a genius pickup that was by the Warriors.
Yeah, it was a panic move. At the time, it was just like, Clay's out, we gotta do something. Season's happening, we gotta do something.
Well, I was more thinking maybe we should have, you know, seen that coming when he missed the bubble and then the Suns went 8-0 without him.
Mm.
If he's that essential, like, why did they not get worse when he was out?
Interesting. Distracted by his looks, potentially?
That's what the streets are saying. That's what the streets are saying is about him. Like, literally every time, like, you bring up Kelly Oubre, like, people, like, you know, I have like female friends who will all say that, like, Kelly Oubre is like the hottest NBA player. So, like, that's definitely a thing.
It is a thing. DeRozan and the Spurs. I've watched two Spurs games this year. DeJounte Murray is a delight. Kellen Johnson's really good for them now. Did not see that coming. Lonnie Walker's not developing all that well. Derek White is solid when he's healthy. LaMarcus Aldridge is shooting threes. DeRozan shooting a little bit. But DeRozan's a passer now. Like, that's one of the weirder things. Like, DeRozan brings the ball up a lot still, but he's just a really good passer. He finds the right guy. He drives and kicks. He's averaging 6.7 assists and only 1.7 turnovers. It's one of the highest ratios in the league. I don't know. I really have enjoyed DeRozan, and I think he's actually, like, one of the few guys who... at the way he's playing now and the way he's evolved quietly, could swing a couple series for some teams. Like, have you changed your tune on DeRozan at all a little bit? Or do you have any strong Spurs takes?
I was never as down on DeRozan as other people were in the first place. But I actually wrote a couple of years ago when he first got to San Antonio about him evolving as a playmaker. And obviously it's kind of gone to a different level this year, but... No, I am happy to see him kind of, you know, this second half of his career, he's kind of shed that reputation that he had before as, like, this inefficient gunner. And I think he would be helpful for a lot of teams, but I also don't think the Spurs necessarily should move him. I think
he's
him and
last
LaMarcus,
year. He's not re-signing. That's the reason. It's like, he's
well,
not
right.
Staying.
Okay. okay, but like again, I this is going back to what I was saying before about how I don't think there's gonna, like, a lot of these, maybe in a normal year you would think, okay, that, you know, this guy they're gonna lose him for nothing, you know, they need to do something, but I just think because of the pandemic, it's gonna be harder for teams to justify, you know, making changes and shaking things up in the middle of the season. Then you got to bring someone in and get them tested a couple of times before they can go in, and then they have to, you know, you're going to have a lot less practice days to get somebody acclimated because, you know, the schedule is so compacted that, like, there's just a whole lot of these other factors that are up in the air that you can't really talk about this stuff like you could in a normal season.
Yeah, but if you're somebody like the Clippers and you're like, Pat Bev's not working, we can't find like the right kind of point guard, do we call the Spurs and be like, hey, DeRozan, you want to be a lead ball handler? And then you just close with DeRozan, Paul George, and Kawhi. And
they don't have the money. I don't think they have the money.
Well, you can do, I was looking at that, you can do Lou Will, Pat Bev, and maybe even a Kennard in there and do that.
I don't know if San Antonio would do that.
No, I don't know. I don't know who the right team is for DeRozan, but I do think there are options for him, and I would like to see him moved. I just would like to selfishly see him on a contender. Like, put him in Milwaukee. Like Milwaukee probably can't do it either, but I would really like to see him in a place like that. I want to see DeRozan on a good contender with where he's at right now in his career, because I don't know how much longer he's got of this.
Well, a lot of those teams that are in that, you know that tier that were hoarding all their cap space for Giannis and are now not getting Giannis or Paul George or whoever else was supposed to be a free agent and wasn't, are, you know, maybe like one of those teams. I think you just kind of ride out this season where he is, unless, you know, a team blows him away with an offer, which I don't think they're going to get an offer for DeMar DeRozan before the deadline on an expiring deal that's so great that they have to just say yes instead of riding out what they have. So I think we're just going to see him go somewhere in free agency.
Interesting. Since trading Harden, the Rockets have the number one defensive rating in basketball. Does that surprise you?
That they have the number one defensive rating? Yeah. Yes. That they're a lot better? No.
Mm.
Just
Steven Silas. Is he a lock for coach of the year? Like, I think this is, like,
I think it's too early for anybody to be
no,
a lock for
the Harden stuff, everything. No. Give it to him now. Steven Silas is a saint and must be protected at all costs.
I'm not against it. I mean, I like him. I've only dealt with him a couple of times personally, but he was the guy that I felt the most bad for during the whole Harden
saga.
Oh,
yeah, 100%.
Grinded for 20 years to become a head coach, and then the first thing he has to deal with is that whole situation. But yeah, he's been great, and, you know, Oladipo has fit in nice. Christian Wood is really good. Wall's been awesome since he got healthy from the knee thing.
Gordon's playing out of his mind again.
Yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
I mean, good. I'm happy for him that, you know, he got out of this, you know, the Harden situation, and now he actually has a functional basketball team that's actually pretty good. I don't know if they're going to close the season with the number one defensive rating, but, you know, good for them.
Yeah, I mean, they quietly have a bunch of defenders. Like, they have David Nwaba, they have Victor Oladipo, they have Dante Exum, they have Christian Wood, they have guys all over the place that can defend. Jayshon Tate, who tries really fucking hard. I don't know, I really like their team, and I'm curious to see what they do with PJ Tucker, who's also on an expiring contract. Victor Oladipo, he'll walk, they'll ride that one out, but...
yeah, that was a Tillman Fertitta wants to save money on an expiring contract.
Yeah, he's riding that one out, I would say. Unless the Heat just give them all kinds of great stuff, which is unlikely.
I don't know how interested the Heat actually are in Oladipo.
Doesn't he work out there? He's like
all of the leaks about him, about the Heat as a destination, I think there's more interest from him in joining the Heat than there is from the Heat in getting him.
Well, it seems like that's the sentiment across the league, right? Like, what did he say the other day? Or about, like, no, they quit on me, or blah, blah,
they
blah.
Quit on me. Which is the same thing as, remember when, like, yeah, when Kobe was, like, doing his farewell tour, and he was, like, basically, like, writing the whole, like, script for, like, how his career went, and he was talking about how the Hornets didn't want him, as if he didn't, like, say that if any team besides the Lakers drafted him, he was going to go overseas.
Yeah, you know, I read that whole story again because did you ever read the Jonathan Abrams book? I'm blanking.
Boys Among Men. Yeah.
Yes.
Years ago when it came out, I haven't read it recently.
Well, he has like multiple chapters on that and how it all went down with Calipari and the Nets and Nash, with the Nets and like Kobe's agent telling like we're not going there and then the Nets being scared to not do it. But it was all a bluff. And then, the Hornets stuff is awful because, like, Vlade Divac was, like, really upset about getting moved to Charlotte. And they were like, hey, we got to do it. Sorry, we love you. And he's, like, the nice guy. But, like, hey, it's Kobe and Shaq. We got to do this. Charlotte was totally fine with taking Kobe. They just, they did not want him. It was a, hey,
my point is that Oladipo apparently last year was openly asking players 100%. On other teams, hey, can I come play for your team? And then he opted out of the bubble and then opted in without kind of without telling anybody what he was going to do. And then he gets traded and then he comes out and says, my team quit on me.
Didn't his sister get involved with something?
Drama. There was some of that. I know Bradley Beal's sister is very online.
Never going to be very online, folks. I would highly discourage it.
Especially when you're like the sibling of an NBA player who may or may not want out of their I just remember Bradley Beal's sister was like tweeting at Zach Lowe and like being mad at him for not putting Brad on his all NBA team a couple years ago.
Yeah, hope Zach Lowe learned his lesson. The Mavs. Quickly, and as we wrap up here, they're hitting 32.8% of their threes this season. This is last in the NBA. Seth Curry not being around matters, but also Dorian Finney-Smith coming back is just he's not the same kind of guy. They don't have a lot of shooting, not having Porzingis, and even when they do have Porzingis, he's
Porzingis
not
been
well.
Terrible.
Yeah, exactly. So when you look at it, and you're like, damn, they were the number one in offense last year. Now they're 19th as a whole. When you watch the Mavs. And you look at what's happening this season, how much do you think you can fix, and how much of this did you expect?
I don't think this team's very good. And, I mean, the Seth guy...
Yeah, look at the rotation. Like, when people talk about these... I'm like, look at their rotation. What do you want them to do? What do you want Brooks to do?
Right. Like, you mean Rick Carlisle?
No. I'm saying, like, the same situation in Washington, where I'm, like, seeing these rotations, and I'm like, what are you supposed to do with this?
Yeah, they're not... I mean... Everybody like Luka's awesome, but everybody else is just like
Bradley Beal's
like,
awesome, and everybody else.
And
sucks.
Even Luka has like I remember Luka like I know going into the season, Luka was kind of the media favorite to win MVP this year, and he's been really good, but he hasn't gone supernova the way I think a lot of people thought he would. I think he's not better than he was last year, which is still really good, but like. I think a lot of the early projections for the Mavs were anticipating that Luka was going to go from being an MVP candidate, like a fringe, like third place or fourth place MVP candidate, to being like the MVP front runner, and he hasn't quite made that leap. And then also his team is not very good, and Porzingis might just be done physically.
Man, I really hope he's not done. That is,
I mean, when you're that big and you've had that many knee surgeries, it can get kind of dark pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, look at DeMarcus Cousins. I know he's been okay this year, but like he had an Achilles, a quad, and an ACL surgery on the same leg in 18 months, and you know it's just when you're that big,
it's over.
Yeah,
it's sad. Sean Hyken, what can we check out from you this week on the interwebs?
Well, just check my stuff out at Bleacher Report. I have a few different things I'm working on that are in varying stages of completion. And other than that, you can just follow me on Twitter at Hyken.
Go do that. Keep up the great work, my friend. It was great catching up with you tonight. I greatly appreciate it. Let's talk again soon. Don't be a stranger.
Absolutely.
All right, we're back on a Wednesday morning edition of the Chase Jones Podcast, and I am now joined by Mark Emmert. Mark, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Chase?
I'm pretty good. How many times do you get mistaken for the NCAA figure?
On Twitter, frequently. Never in real life, of course. But yeah. But I get a lot of what you would call mean tweets, especially if if something is going on in the world of college sports that a particular fan base does not like, they think that they should tell me about that. So I've learned to laugh about it. At first, it was kind of annoying and almost startling to see some of the vitriol that came my way. I was like, oh my gosh, what's this? But then after a while, I realized that they don't know any better. So I try to play along with it.
I think they do know better. They're just lazy. Don't give them that. Don't give them the credit there.
I just can't believe they think that Mark Emmer is actually on Twitter, like just sitting there under his own like his name, just waiting for them to call him out. Like, why would he do that?
Steve Cohen,
it was kind of funny. We talked about it.
Steve Cohen, the Mets owner, just on Twitter talking about moves. You never know, man. You never know.
I guess. It is kind of an uncommon name, but. Man, I can't wait for him to retire.
Well, maybe sooner rather than later. We have to start with Luke Garza. You cover Iowa basketball, Mark, and things are going really well for them this year. Where I'm a student at the University of Tennessee, things are topsy-turvy, and they went 12 minutes to that field goal last night. So that is the state of Tennessee basketball. You don't have that problem with the team you're covering because your team is number one in offense per KenPom. Is Luke Garza going to win National Player of the Year?
I think so. I think he was really close last year. I actually voted for him for the Wooden over Obi Toppin. I know it was a close call, and he finished second. He's leading the nation in scoring, and he's playing in the Big Ten. So that tells you a lot. He's the toughest league in the country. He's just unstoppable. I mean, night in and night out. He had 27-12 last night, and they beat Michigan State. He is pretty phenomenal. I mean, I know there's other really great players out there, but I just can't see anybody else overcoming him for player of the year.
Yeah, there's no one else who really stands out this year. Baylor, it's like a hodgepodge. Mm-hmm. Gonzaga, it's a hodgepodge. It's not like any of the great teams have like one guy who's doing a bunch. It's not going to be Vescovi from Tennessee. I'm just going to go ahead and tell you that. They are number one in adjusted offense. Like I said with KenPom, what have you seen that makes this offense just so deadly this season?
Yeah, I mean, they've been good for a long time. That's kind of a Frank McCaffrey hallmark. But, obviously they got guards in the middle. He can get his anytime he wants it. But they've got three really good three-point shooters around him in West Temple, Hong, and Frederick, typically. Now, they weren't last night. And then they've got Connor McCaffrey, Coach Frank McCaffrey's son, is a really, really good facilitator. Leads the nation in assist turnover ratio. He does a good job of getting the ball where it needs to go. And then they got a really good bench. I mean, they got two guys on the bench that have started games here in the past, in Jack Nungy and Joe Toussaint. They've got some really good freshmen that are coming in and playing bigger roles now, and Keegan Murray in particular. But even last night, we saw Tony Perkins come in and really, really do a good job. So they've just got a deep team. They like to get out and run. I mean, offense is their hallmark. It's fun to watch when they're clicking that way, and you just can't. I mean, you just can't focus on Garza. Even last night, Michigan State did not double team him a lot. They were trying to, just throw different bodies at him, and he drew 12 fouls. So basically, all their guys got in foul trouble. But he had four or five bodies. Izzo had four or five bodies that he wanted to use there, try to like keep Garza, occupied, and that didn't work either. So they're really, really difficult to stop, and especially I think once we get to the tournament, like teams that have not had a chance to play against them or scout them well. They're going to have a really tough time adjusting to Iowa's offense. That's never been the issue for Iowa, though. It's always been defense. It's a question mark there.
Well, how do you feel about their defense this season? Is it good enough for them to really make a national title run?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, you like to think so because you see it, in action that this team could get to the Final Four, but, they're still not good enough there. It would be historic if they made the Final Four with that defensive ranking in the KenPom era. Right now, they're 90th coming into last night's game. I haven't looked today. That's really, really not good enough historically.
You're like Pizarro, Tennessee.
Yeah, right. And usually those teams that get to the Final Four, as you know, are pretty balanced. Really, really, top 10 offense, maybe top 20 defense at least. And Iowa's just not that way. They never have been that way. And what happens with them is they struggle in pretty much everywhere. I mean, they can play the zone, they play the man. And eventually teams will figure out either one, so they've got to keep kind of switching defenses back and forth. They don't have any elite, really one-on-one defenders. Their best defensive players are on the bench, and that's what happened last night. I mean, Michigan State was shooting 21% from three in its last three games. They came out and hit their first six against Iowa. really weren't even contested out there. And so Fran McCaffrey went to his bench, brought in some guys that actually wanted to come out and kind of contest those three-pointers. His starters sat for most of that game last night. They went with his bench players just because they were better on defense. And that's why they won 84-78, but it was still a struggle, and it shouldn't have been. I mean, Michigan State was really a wounded team coming in here, not playing well at all. And Iowa kind of let them hang around well into the final seconds of the game. And then defense was the issue, I mean, especially right at the outset. I mean, they had 26 points after 8 minutes of the game, Michigan State. And, you know, that's really, in a tournament setting, if you let some team get out of you like that. Yeah, we saw it a couple years ago with Tennessee, actually.
Yeah.
Iowa, right? You know, I would have mentioned to claw back and force overtime. It was a great comeback by them. But, you know, you just can't be falling behind like that in tournament games and expecting to survive every game, because the competition gets harder and harder as you go farther into that tournament. So to win four straight games and get to the Final Four, boy, they really, really better lock down that defensive end, because I just don't see that succeeding long term.
Who is a bigger matchup problem for them? Let's just say for the Iowa fans, you get to the Final Four and you're matched up with either Gonzaga or Baylor. Who do you think is the more complicated matchup for them?
Well, we've seen Gonzaga against them, and that didn't look good. That was up in the Sioux Falls, South Dakota in December. I covered that game, and Gonzaga kind of had their way with Iowa there, especially Jalen Suggs. They really do, I'll say this, when they lose games, it's typically because they can't handle the opposing point guard. I mean, it was Jalen Suggs that game, Marcus Carr of Minnesota in that game. Even Rob Finnessy kind of went off for him a little bit when they played Indiana. And then, who am I blanking on? They just got beat by a really good point guard again in the next game. So, Io DeSumo, of course, Illinois. Just beat him 80-75. So that's kind of
really
the biggest struggle.
I think they would take a chance. Really hating on the Illini today, Mark.
Yeah, are you?
No, you're really hating on them. Just leaving them out. They're finally in the top 10 in KenPom. They're finally breaking through Mr. Underwood's team, and just no respect from you, from the NCAA commissioner today.
Team actually, but I do apologize to the Illini fans out there. But so that's been their Achilles heel, really, for the last few years. They're not really good at, you know, defending against penetration. And so, I think they would take the chances with Baylor just because that's a team they haven't seen before. I mean, Gonzaga really was by far superior to Iowa that game. And I think fans might think that Iowa has improved since then, and they probably have. But, you know, Jalen Suggs, Corey Kispert, that would be, boy, that's a tough matchup. It is for anybody, but I think especially for Iowa. So I would say bring on Baylor and see if they can stop Garza.
All right. There you go. The biggest challenger, the best challenger remaining in the Big Ten, do you think it's Illinois or do you think it's Michigan?
I think it's Michigan. I've really been impressed by them. The freshman center they have up there, of course, has really been a revelation. I think Juwan Howard has actually done a great job building that team. Iowa plays there on March 4th. The only time they meet this year. They play already done with Illinois. They don't play them again either, which is unfortunate, I think, for Big Ten fans that those teams only play once. But I do think it's going to come down to Iowa, Michigan, Illinois at the top, and I think I'm going to give the edge to Michigan right now. I think they're the better team.
Interesting. The most under-talked about player on the Iowa Hawkeyes this year is who?
Wow. Well, that's a great question, because they've all been kind of getting a lot of publicity here. I'm just wondering nationally who's under the radar. Probably Connor McCaffrey.
Okay.
I think that because he doesn't score a lot, and last night he went 0-for-4 from 3, which is not his game, so it's probably a tough time to be talking about him. But he really does. His versatility is just so important for this team, both on both ends of the court. He understands his dad's offense, as you might imagine, better than anybody. So he can play three different positions, and sometimes does in the same game. You know, he just moves him around back there, plays the 1-2 or the 4, and he has really been, I think, an important part of. He's making this all work. You know, he doesn't really need his points, so he's fine with his role. You know, Luka Garza said he's the best entry passer he's ever played with. So when Connor missed some time with an injury earlier this year, Luka suffered a little bit because his teammates aren't able to get him the ball where he needs it, when he needs it, as well as Connor McCaffrey can. So I think that he's really kind of an underrated part of this offense. But he's also a guy that can defend multiple positions. And they can put him at the back end of the zone or at the front of the zone. And he really just kind of moves him around where he needs him, you know, game to game. I think last year the game Iowa won at Syracuse, and Connor McCaffrey might have been the most important part of that game just because he was able to kind of get himself in the middle of that Syracuse, that tough zone they play, and really get the ball to where it needed to get to. And I know Bohannon had the points in that game, but Connor McCaffrey was probably the MVP of that game for Iowa. So there are times when he is actually the most important player for them. But there are times when he can take a back seat, too, which I think you need. I mean, you guy that's like really not that ego-driven, and if he only plays 15, 18 minutes a game, that's fine as well.
Interesting. What, in your estimation, makes this team special this year? I know you're not as in on them as a Final Four team, but like, what do you think is working in their favor that makes them different this year?
Well, I think it's really experience for one thing. I mean, they had three guys that came back really just to chase this national championship or a Big Ten championship at least, and that's Garza, Wieskamp, and Bohannon, and all those guys could have gone somewhere after last year. I mean, obviously the COVID thing impacted the situation. There may not have been as many opportunities, but Garza flirted with the NBA. Wieskamp did 2 years ago. Bohannon is a fifth-year senior coming off two hip surgeries. They all came back here with one specific purpose in mind. They're highly motivated, really, really mentally strong group of young men. I think that's going to be a big advantage for them going forward, too. There's just not that many teams in college basketball that average, 22, 23-year-old, starters. I mean, I guess Wisconsin would be the other one. And I think that really is working in their favor. I mean, they really have a singular purpose here. They understand what it is. Garza said last night after the game, he said, I didn't come back to score points. I came back to win games. And I thought that was really a telling comment by him because he went over the 2,000-point mark for his career last night. Only two Hawkeyes have ever done that, he and Roy Marble. So he's going to be the all-time leading scorer here before he leaves. But he came back not for that reason, but he wants to win a championship, and he thinks they're good enough. And so if they do get there, it'll be because of his will. Honestly, he's just really, really a special young athlete. I don't think I've seen anybody quite like him before. His maturity and his leadership, I just think is kind of off the charts. So he might carry this team a long way.
Last thing, and we'll wrap up here. The biggest surprise this season has been what for you covering this team?
Well, Keegan Murray, the true freshman. We didn't really know what to expect from any of the freshmen. He's got five freshmen on his team, and I was thinking coming in, he didn't really need to play any of them. He's got a top eight beyond them that was very experienced, as I said. And so we didn't know how far he had to dip into his bench, but Keegan Murray has really been he's just been too good to not play. I mean, he actually got a start here two games ago when C.J. Frederick was out. And so he's been a really a really great defensive player, honestly. I mean, he leads the team in block shots and steals, or he's in the top two in both those categories, and even though he's a bench player, 6'8 kid. He's got a twin brother, Chris, that plays here. His dad, Kenyon, played here, so he's a legacy guy. But he was not really highly recruited. But he's coming here and actually shown that he's probably one of the top, 7-8 players in this team, and that's saying a lot. So he's given them a lot off the bench this year. And, honestly, that game at Rutgers, they don't win that game without Keegan Murray. I mean, he was so big down the stretch with those two big free throws, of course, to seal it. He's been a really, really a revelation for a lot of people. And the Iowa fans already love him. He's like a fan favorite here already and probably will be for years to come.
All right, Mark, what can we check out from you this week in the Des Moines Register?
Well, that's a three-game week for the Hawkeyes. So they beat Michigan State last night. That's their list. There's only one. And they play Ohio State here tomorrow night. Big game, number 7 versus number 8, and then they go to Indiana on Super Bowl Sunday to play the Hoosiers and try to get a little payback there. That was a game they should not have lost at home. So I'm going to have a big Luca Garza story in the Sunday paper. I actually have a talk to Luca after I talk to you just about his growth, as I mentioned, as a leader, like what his influences have been, how he's kind of molded himself as a guy that's like controlling that locker room. Had a really, really interesting, encounter with Nick Saban as a recruit when he was being recruited by Alabama. So I'm definitely going to ask him about that. I got a picture from his dad with him and Nick Saban in Nick Saban's office. It's kind of funny because Nick Saban looks really, really short in that picture. So just kind of who has impacted him as a leader. And I think it's going to be kind of revelatory as well. I hope it is at least. So people want to check that out. I'll probably have that online on Friday.
All right, go do that. Keep up the great work, my friend, and we'll check it back in again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Chase. Appreciate your time.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.